Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. I'm Captain Ed Garibay, the lead author of Army Techniques publication 390.96. Arctic and Extreme Cold Weather Operations, the Army and Marine Corps' new manual for the Arctic region. In today's podcast, we'll be talking about the release of this crucial new piece of doctrine, as well as the growing importance of the Arctic. ATP 390.96 marks the Army's first Arctic-specific manual in more than half a century, providing a comprehensive guide for planning and conducting operations in one of the world's most challenging environments. This release comes as interest in the Arctic continues to rise due to geopolitical shifts. In recent years, federal government, the Department of Defense, and the Army have all published strategies for the Arctic region, which has emerged as a focal point for military exercises, training, and strategic planning. Yet, even with all this attention, a key question remains. Why would we ever need to fight somewhere so desolate and cold? What's worth fighting for in the Arctic? To help answer these questions, we're joined by two distinguished guests, Major General Joseph Hilbert, the Commanding General of 11th Airborne Division Arctic Angels in Alaska, and Colonel Retired Rich Creed, Director of the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate, also known as CAD. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ed.
Good to be here, Ed. Thanks.
So before we talk about the doctrine, I first want to talk about the Arctic, what it is and why it's so important, because it's a region that I don't think a lot of people are very familiar with. And I think in most people's mind, when they think of the Arctic, they think of ice caps and polar bears, but they can't imagine why the Army or the nation in general would be interested in it. General Hilbert, as the commanding general of the Army's only Arctic division, can you explain why this region's so important?
Yeah, sure, Ed. So I think I'd start with two things. I'm gonna give you a quote, and then I'm gonna tell you, kind of speak to the biases that you just mentioned in your intro there. So first the quote, and we say it quite a bit around here. It's from Billy Mitchell, and it's a famous Arctic quote where he made the comment, "He who controls Alaska controls the world." And when you think about why he's saying that and the time period that he's saying it, you might scratch your head a bit if you're biased by every map that we've seen in a classroom from third grade forward, right? Your standard flat maps, I like to say flat maps lie, right? Your standard flat map, you've got the Urals on the right-hand side of the map. And then as you come to the center, you know, you're going to see the Atlantic Ocean. Then you're going to see the Western Hemisphere kind of centered on the map. Then you're going to see the Pacific Ocean. Then you're going to see Asia out to about mid-Russia on the left-hand side of the map. And then there's going to be this kind of squiggly line at the top that's going to have white at the top, and it's going to be squiggly at the bottom that's going to represent the Arctic and Antarctica. And you would see Alaska, the United States portion of the Arctic, you'd see Alaska sitting over there on the left-hand side of the map on the north part of the Pacific. But if you think about a globe, you suddenly get perspective. And you understand the Billy Mitchell quote, why this terrain becomes strategic. And you think about us today. So we can be from the 11th Airborne Division here in Alaska. We can be on the border of Finland and Russia faster than anybody at Fort Bragg if you go over the pole. We can be in North Asia and even down to Taiwan faster than the 25th Infantry Division in Hawaii. And when you put that in perspective, and then you think about the Aleutian Chain that comes through the Bering Sea in the North Pacific. If you look at the Aleutian Chain, some I've heard it say that they'll call it the third island chain. I would argue it's really the second island chain. Ties right into the northern islands of Japan and on south, right? When you look at the Aleutians. And that's why they were strategic in World War II. That's why they remain strategic today as shipping goes through the Bering Straits and then heads toward either the north or, you know, Northwest Passage. So it becomes a critical terrain just based on geography. As far as, like, you know, fighting in the Arctic and, you know, the thought they say of the polar bears and the, you know, the ice flows and things like that, we like to think of hot wars in cold places. Right. So if you think about our own history, the coldest battle Americans fought was the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir at minus 30 degrees. And so those temperatures, while on the Korean Peninsula, we see the same thing when we train at JPMRC here and when we train with our other Arctic allies, either Sweden, Finland, Norway, Denmark, over in Europe or Canada, you know, right next door north of us. Right. So really, when you put that perspective on it, you realize it's not just fighting north of a certain latitude. It's not just fighting in a portion of the globe that's close to the pole. It's really the ability to fight in extreme cold weather and the ability to be anywhere faster. And that's how this region gets to be incredibly strategic. And then kind of the last part of it is when you do look at Alaska, when you do look at the Arctic region, and when you think about the world as a globe, and you think about the amount of traffic that transits over, going east to west, coming over the poles, you then begin to understand why missile defense becomes in critical infrastructure up here when we think about some of the space and missile defense sites that we've got up here at Fort Greely and elsewhere in Alaska that are really protecting the homeland. And it wouldn't take, it doesn't take a long conversation with anybody in that community for them to come up and tell you very quickly, this is strategic terrain for them as well. So it's just an incredibly strategic location for us. And it's an environment that we can't turn our backs on.
I'd agree with General Hurlbut. I mean, the geography is, you just can't argue with that. That's got to be the most critical consideration. Related to that, obviously, is natural resources. And then those strategic lines of communications that increasingly seem like they're open to maritime trade, right? So that's important. I think in our current version of FM30, Army's Capstone Operations Doctrine, we have a chapter that talks about operations in a maritime domain. Well, one of the theaters or geographical regions of the world that we talk about being a maritime domain includes the Arctic, not just Indo-PACOM, but there's other places. And it's that ability to influence what happens in the air and maritime, the larger electromagnetic spectrum and so forth, that really brings home the importance of that ability to have a land force in such a geographically critical part of the world. Let's talk about threats. The Russian North Sea fleet's up there, significant proportion of their second strike capability, their nuclear ballistic missile submarines are based up there, and they need to come and go from their bases in Murmansk and other places. We had an interesting trip a few years ago, sir, that you would have really enjoyed going on. Our NATO allies, it was a Norway's turn to host this land operations working group. So they decided to host us in Kirkenes, which is the northernmost city in Norway. It's only got about 5,000 people in it. And what was interesting is you walked around this little town. One, you could see out the fjord to the sea lanes. But the other thing that was interesting is you had those typical European yellow road signs that said Murmansk, 112 kilometers, right? And that border was actually pretty heavily traveled back and forth there. And the reason why they wanted to host us there was to show how close they were to the Russian bear and that the role they had to play. And that was shortly after the Army published its Arctic strategy, which really started the ball rolling towards 11th Airborne coming into being, right, is to fulfill that Arctic strategy. And it was interesting to hear the Norwegians, and I would imagine the Russians, talk about the importance of those land masses that far north and the ability to influence those sea lanes, those gigantic convoys that enabled Lend-Lease in the Second World War. I mean, that was a strategic line of communication for the Soviet Union, just like it is for Russia now. I think the other consideration, and it's something that we had talked about, and we certainly talked with your team and your predecessors up there, is sometimes people have a failure of imagination, right? There's an awful lot of important economic infrastructure that powers the U.S. economy up there. So it's more than just air missile defense. We've got oil reserves, fisheries, all of these kinds of things up there, and some very important air bases that the Air Force uses that they can't secure by themselves without having our Army forces somewhere in the region should their crisis develop. So I think there's a whole bunch of other considerations there, making sure that we have some sort of doctrine that's fit for purpose up there. And frankly, and Ed and I had talked about this for the couple of years he was working on this book, we hadn't really paid any attention to that since the Cold War had ended, right? I mean, if you remember back in the Cold War, they had a movie called Ice Station Zebra, and you had thrillers written about the competition between the U.S. and the Soviets up in the northern latitudes. So all of those things, I think, underpin what you said, that, hey, there's an important responsibility here. It's a national responsibility, and it's part of the Army fulfilling its joint responsibilities.
Yeah, Rich, you kind of hit on the joint perspective on it, too. If flat maps lie, we also get very myopic in our vision of domains, right? And we think land power is merely land versus land on the land. But the reality is we can hold sea lanes at bay. We can hold airspace at bay. And we can do things as part of a joint force that enable one another. That's what our doctrine's built around. We get myopically focused and we think, okay, well, you just need to know how to use your machine gun up in the Arctic, or you need to know how to use your satellite communications in the Arctic for, a land force versus a land force. That's probably not what the future looks like. It's probably a land force holding a maritime force, or holding an air force, or even a space force at bay from the land domain, right? And so that's how we got to think about it. And you're exactly right. This was a capability we had in our Army in the Cold War, because we understood the vital infrastructure that we had to defend. We also understood where we'd have to fight. That was the whole 6th Infantry Division Arctic. But we transitioned from being an Arctic division, the 6th Infantry Division of the early, late 1980s, early 1990s. We transitioned from that to really being forces stationed in the Arctic that we would project power from. What the regaining Arctic dominance, the Army's Arctic strategy built on the national strategy for the Arctic region, what it really did was it recreated an Arctic capable force. And it recreated for the U.S. Army an Arctic and extreme cold weather capable division. Because this is not the environment that you can come to unprepared. It will kill you. But if you know how to fight in it, and you know how to understand, you understand it, and you know how to use it to your advantage, it becomes part of your force. And it becomes, you've got to really learn how to thrive up here. You can't just survive. You've got to learn how to use the cold to your advantage. And you got 100 historical examples where that's been the case, whether it's the Finns and the Finno-Russian War, whether it's what we saw in Korea. Even now, highest battle in the world right now is between the line of control between China and India, at well over 10,000 feet. You don't come to that environment unprepared.
I think you bring up a fantastic point of framing the issue, because I think a lot of people that I talked to when we were developing this manual struggled to think about where Arctic operations would happen. And when you think about it in more than just a land domain, you think about it from a multi-domain perspective and how that impacts sea lines of communication, air lines of communication. It really becomes clear where the land domain's contribution to that is in Arctic operations. It really begins to take shape.
We even had to make a case with some of our allies early on in this conversation. I mean, they collaborated with us. We obviously wanted to use other people's subject matter expertise to help us just think through the problem set. But I remember discussions with some Canadians who were like, we're not going to do anything up here. But this was all pre-2022, when it didn't look like Russia was ever going to be that particularly aggressive again. Everybody changed their tune really fast since 2022. And then our new allies, I mean, they've always been partners, but Finland and Sweden are now NATO allies. So we have an obligation to be competent up there, not just from a U.S. perspective, but from an alliance perspective.
And you can't isolate the threat to just Russia. I mean, make no mistake, with the Chinese declaring themselves a near Arctic country, which I think all of us scratch our heads a little bit on and say, what do you mean by that, other than that you have interest up here? And you see these, we'll put air quotes around research stations that they build in the Arctic region that we know are dual purpose stations and other things, right? So there's competition in this space. There's absolute competition in this space. And we all realize it. And I think we've all kind of woke back up to this space and what we need to do to be competitive up here.
Thanks, gentlemen. So I'd like to turn and talk about the manual itself, which is ATP 390.96, Arctic and Extreme Cold Weather Operations.
But first, I want to give our audience just a kind of brief overview on what Arctic operations is from a doctrinal standpoint, because there's a lot of discussion over what is the Arctic, and it means a lot of things to a lot of different people. And depending on who you talk to, it can mean a number of different things based on vegetation or latitude, or even just a synonym for the word cold. And that kind of leads to a lot of confusion. And so in this manual, we didn't want to redefine the Arctic again. We didn't want to provide yet another definition. What we did was we created categories in which they're traditionally defined. And that's by latitude, by climate, and by terrain.
And so commanders can use these three categories as ways to think about the Arctic and the challenges and the problems that they need to ask questions about, because latitude amplifies periods of daylight and darkness, also has solar disruptions that affect your communications. Climate affects the severity of the cold and has this unique Arctic weather. And in terrain, you have many different types of terrain that you may not even be used to, from glaciers in the ice cap to the tundra, which is a polar desert, or the boreal forests in the subarctic. And each of those require a different approach. And so rather than define the Arctic, what we do is we define Arctic operations, which are actions executed in ice cap, tundra, and boreal terrain that require special techniques and equipment. And that really sets the foundation for the rest of the Army and provides this standardized way in which to approach the Arctic. And then one other important thing to mention is that this is the Army's cold weather manual, because everything that you need to operate in the cold is also necessary in the Arctic. The Arctic is just the most extreme version. And so all those fundamentals still apply. So that's the doctrinal kind of foundation of what it is. But Mr. Creed, sir, could you talk about the importance of this manual and its release?
Well, I think General Hilbert kind of touched on it. Well, first of all, we hadn't updated it significantly with any firsthand research or any real particular interest by the Army for a very long time. We also didn't have all the latest information, right? So it would be nice to just wheel out, you know, Cold War era doctrine and then say, okay, we'll just do all this stuff that we used to do up there. Well, the force is completely different. And the force had not been training those things with their current equipment at any large scale, I don't think above battalion level, since like 2003 or 2004. It had been a very long time. So that was a bit of a challenge. The importance, though, I think we've touched on before, is the realization that we have got to be prepared to fight the most demanding environment in the world against any potential adversary for a host of different reasons. And we weren't going to be able to choose the time and place where that would occur. It may happen in Alaska. It may happen, as General Hilbert said, in Sweden or Finland or Norway or even Canada. So the importance of getting this right is that a whole lot of the rest of the Army may have to fall in on that doctrine, or we would need to train people, say, down in CONUS on the fundamentals of that doctrine before they ever flowed into theater. That would be an ideal approach. But the bottom line is you have to have the right intellectual models in place from which to depart if we had to grow the Army or if we had to move additional forces into a similar environment. Now, we couldn't do this book like we've done other books. There's a collective level of knowledge on most topics. You know, you're going to talk about desert operations. That's the easy one to pick, right? I mean, everybody in the Army above age 35 has fought or deployed to someplace in the desert. So you get some sort of familiarity with that. The percentage of people in the force that had experience with operations in an Arctic climate is very small. It's always been very small. And it was smaller than it was 50 years ago. So we really had to reach out, starting with the most senior people in Alaska, in U.S. Army Alaska, predating the 11th Airborne Division, when there was no 6th Infantry Division there to talk to. And we found ourselves talking to a lot of civilians who were retired up there that had some experience. We spent time talking to the Allies. And we realized that the writing effort, the ground zero for the writing effort, needed to be in Alaska with your team, sir. And that's why we made the author spend a lot of time there the last few years, going to schools, going to observe exercises, and actually, you know, get a feel for what we put them in charge of writing about. So it was a very different approach, and I think it's one that's paid off quite a bit.
Yeah, we sincerely appreciated the cooperation, and especially coming up in the winter. We like to say friends visit in the winter. Right. And so our doctrine writers are our friends. But we knew that, you know, our contribution to this is not an 11th Airborne Division Arctic Operations Manual. If it was, it would be called an SOP. But it is a doctrinal manual that the entire Army can use, because we know that in times of crisis, or we assume in times of crisis, sure, we could stay here in Alaska. We could also go somewhere else, and somebody else may have to come up and operate in this environment, or we may need help. Or we may need others to be able to come and operate with us. And if we do, we've all got to start as with all things, with a common doctrinal framework from which we can depart and build upon our SOPs. So getting that right was important for the Army. It was important for us as a division, but it was important that it was not just the 11th Airborne Division's manual, but that it was the Army's manual, so that anybody, whether, you know, I'll pick on the guard in Guam, if they had to come up here, we've got to be able to give them a doctrinal point of departure, you know, coming from one of the warmest climates we've got to one of the coldest, so they understand what this environment is like, so that they need to operate here. No different than getting a jungle operations manual would be absolutely appropriate for us to use should we have to leave Alaska.
Yes, sir. You know, that you just triggered a funny recollection. We were all out at U.S. Army Pacific last year, and General Flynn was talking about the efforts of the 11th Airborne and the things that you guys have been working on and the importance of the mission there. But he made a very interesting point. He said, you can bring a unit from someplace else in the world to a jungle climate or a more temperate climate somewhere in the Pacific, and they'll do very well. In fact, battalions and brigades from your division routinely do very well in those opposite climates, right? Because you've got this mindset that the climate's not going to get you down, but you can't do the reverse very easily without all that preparation, right? So that was a pretty big shout out, I thought, to a rather large and senior audience about the importance of what you just said.
It's important. I mean, we get up here and you just think about what some of the challenges are. It's what the cold does, and it's the cold's effect on both the human and the machine. And so, you know, you think across the Dotmel PF, it changes the way that you train. It changes the way you develop your leaders. It absolutely changes your material solutions. Kind of to your point, Rich, you bring that human being up here that has to operate in this environment. If they're not prepared for understanding, for example, the increased caloric intake it's going to take to protect you from the cold, if they don't understand how fast you can get frostbite or you're susceptible to cold weather injuries, that's going to cause problems. Equally, if they don't understand what their material, how their material is going to affect to it, how it's going to break down, that's part of it. And it's more than the science, but just even how it changes some of the ways you think about fighting. At certain temperatures below 25, you start to, you know, you can shoot a machine gun, you're going to create ice fog in front of your weapon system that's going to silhouette your position that you wouldn't think about anywhere else, because the environment's just doing something different. And so when that happens, how do you then fight differently? How do you organize yourself differently to operate in this environment? And so you can't just think of it in terms of like, here's how you wear your cold weather equipment the right way. Here's some cold weather MREs. We'll give you some different fluids for your vehicle and you're off to the races. Now, all that, things are going to take a lot longer. How your body's going to break down, that stuff's going to take a little bit longer. You've got to apply all that, and you may have to organize yourself differently. You got to train yourself differently. You got to develop your leaders differently. So that's starting with that D, and then working across the Dotmel PF just becomes pretty critical. And so again, super happy that we got to participate with CAD on getting that thing written, but super glad to do it for the Army and to be able to help us as a force to just understand what this environment's like and how do we dominate in it.
Hey, sir, I had a question. So how long does it typically take company commanders, your field grade officers and so forth, to understand the difference in the planning factors? Like, is it just a one time, you know, your first exercise, it kind of dawns on you that you've got to account for these different timelines of execution? Or is it something that it's very context dependent?
Yeah, Rich, I think it's context dependent. When you look at, so I'll talk through our leader development model for all leaders. So all leaders who come up here, and we'll define leaders as, you know, platoon sergeants and up, right? We'll go through a cold weather orientation course. We're going to take you out for 3 days. That includes a major general who shows up and has never been in the Arctic environment before, like yours truly. You're going to go through that course, and we're going to give you the knowledge of what it takes to lead in this environment. And then we're going to take you out for 3 days, and we're going to help you understand how to use the equipment up here, what the cold's doing to you, how to build a cold weather training program, what the risks are. And so you're going to get that academic basis. Our junior leaders, and I'm going to put them in the staff sergeant to sergeant model, will go through a cold weather indoctrination course. That's about 2 weeks long, where they are going to learn the hands-on part of how they're going to train this to their formations. And then what ends up happening every year as we enter the winter training cycle, everyone will go through a refresher training, if you will, or cold weather indoctrination training at the unit level with that, with those unit leaders driving that through that. So you've gotten the academic portion, but then you're going to get the hands-on. And I think that's where it gets to the it depends part of your answer. How long does it take? You certainly get the classroom experience and you understand it, but until you actually do it a few times and you get the reps under you, you begin to understand that we're not kidding when we say it takes 3 to 4 times longer to do even basic tasks when it's extremely cold. Simple things as from zipping up your jacket, trying to put your snowshoes on with mitts, those sound silly, but until you do it a few times, you don't learn kind of maybe some of the tricks of the trade of it, and you don't get the we'll misuse the term Fingerspitzengefühl a bit that it takes to just understand the nuances of how your own, you know, soldiers, regardless of what echelon, from the fire team up to the battalion, how they're reacting to the environment, how they're fighting in the environment, where they're thriving in the environment, and where the environment's, you know, taking a toll on them, so that then you can work your own fighter management. You absolutely have to lay that academic basis first, and then it is an experiential knowledge that helps you understand the application of that, just like with anything else, that only gets better over time with more reps and sets. We have the saying up here, you only get good in extreme cold weather by training in it. And so we're going to go hard in the winter months. That's our fighting season. And we're going to train hard in those winter months and maximize the worst conditions because it's the best time to train.
And, you know, sir, you mentioned a number of challenges. I think one of the interesting things I like to highlight to people is that the Arctic challenges are more than just the cold. I think a lot of people, when they start thinking about it, they get hung up on just how cold it is and how much they hate being cold. They forget about mobility and they forget about how challenging it is to move. And I think you can survive if you can overcome the cold. But if you want to overcome the enemy in the cold, you need to be able to move.
Well, there's the other mobility aspect too. When it's not cold, I imagine that being roadbound is not necessarily a tactical advantage when everything turns into a bog and that permafrost.
You're exactly right, Rich. You know, the stream that's frozen in the winter, that is your high speed avenue of approach, and it's the method by which you resupply yourself because it becomes the superhighway. The minute it warms up and the ice breaks, just became a linear danger area. and became severely restricted terrain. And so you watch this kind of weird, I'll call it weird, where you would think that the cold would limit your mobility. In some ways, it's the exact opposite. The colder it is, the more things are frozen solid, the better your mobility, right? And then the warmer it is, all that water goes somewhere, and you get into this Arctic bog or the muskeg, you know, that we'd say that's just, it's marshy and spongy, and it's going to slow you down, and it's going to bog you down, and now you're limited to the limited roads that you've got, because you're not getting through that muskeg. So getting an appreciation for what it's like, both warm and cold, it's a dynamically changing environment, right? Just through the seasons. If you think about your temperate zones, they're generally consistent in terms of what the terrain looks like. Might get cold and icy, but it's, you know, your mobility corridors or your mobility corridors or your mobility corridors. Up here, they're going to change drastically between summer and winter.
And it's one of the few areas, you know, where at the right time of year, the maritime domain becomes the land domain and vice versa. I tell people that tactics and doctrine generally kind of stay the same in Arctic operations. Everything else about the world that you fundamentally know changes. And so if you're unfamiliar with the region and you don't have enough experience or training in it, it can be really easy to overlook a problem that can have substantial impacts on your operation. But I want to start looking forward into the future of Arctic operations. What do you gentlemen think Arctic operations looks like for the Army in the future?
I'll give it a shot and then I'll punt over to Rich to... with a little more forward thinking, potentially. I think you hit it, Ed, kind of on the point of it is a multi-domain fight in the Arctic in the sense where you said, you know, you've got land that becomes maritime in certain seasons, but it's a region that's rich with resources, that's that's certainly contested. And so it's a region where we're going to have to learn how to campaign and we're going to have to learn how to compete in this region. And I think the space is only going to get more competitive. We talked about China becoming a near Arctic nation. We certainly, Russia is an Arctic nation. And when we look at some of their designs on what this region looks like, they're not as, we'll just call them not as wholesome, maybe as others when we think about free trade and we think about passage. And so what that means is we've got to look as a land domain. What do we do up here? How do we compete in an Arctic region? How do we compete in an extreme cold weather environment from the land domain, whether it is in a supporting role to other domains, whether it is supported by other domains, but most certainly how it is integrated with all of the domains that are up here?
Yeah, I would agree on all that, sir. I'd throw in that, you know, the way things look in the future, a lot of it's going to depend on the threats, what our adversaries are doing. I don't think anybody, at least from an Army perspective, views Alaska or, you know, the Arctic as the main effort necessarily. But we talk about competition all the time. Well, we're competing to do what, right? And so there's different types of competition, but national competition, there's always a military component to it. For us to deter malign actors from doing things contrary to our interests up there, we have to demonstrate that we are extremely competent, we're extremely capable, and quite frankly, we're extremely lethal. So that, all right, you're going to pick a place to fight. This is not where you want to fight us. And that means punching above your weight class, I think, an awful lot of the time. And then trying to get as many of our friends involved on Team America as possible. But I agree with everything you're saying. I think all, from an economic standpoint, a resource standpoint, we'll see which way the climate goes. It seems like every year it seems to switch directions. I guess that's why they call it change. But certainly all the indicators are that your part of the world up there and the Army's responsibility is only going to get more important.
We certainly see it that way. I mean, if you just look, we'll talk in the air domain. If you look at the ADIZ incursions that Russia has had on our own airspace up here over the past couple of years, they just increase every year. And I think they're on mark right now to increase from what was a calendar year 24 or maybe FY 24. But regardless, we're seeing increased incursions. We saw last year the first joint bomber patrol with Russia and China up here. I think it's easy to kind of turn a blind eye or maybe not think much about it. But I mean, that's U.S. sovereign territory and U.S. sovereign airspace being encroached upon by a bear bomber and U.S. sovereign airspace being encroached upon by the Russian and the Chinese together. We saw last year the largest naval exercise that Russia has done with a joint Chinese component. And it came up through the Bering Strait and through the, through the North Pacific. So this is competitive space, and it's competitive space next to, U.S. sovereign territory. And so as a land force, we owe the joint force a capability that both defends it and deters our adversaries from activity in and around it. And we just got to think differently about what that looks like. It's probably not six armored BCTs in Alaska, right?
Right.
but there's a way to deter an adversary up here. And to Rich, to your point, I mean, we know deterrence theory says it's got to be credible, it's got to be competent, it's got to be lethal, and so that's what we think we offer up here. But we've got to continue to develop that and push that forward and demonstrate that lethality, that capability up here that says this is the opportunity cost. Up here is not worth it. You need to go elsewhere. That's what we need to be able to do as land power up here.
Are there any other ways we can think about how we wrap our arms around this problem of Arctic dominance? Or you brought up quite a few.
Well, I mean, I think you've got to make decisions about very fundamental things just from an Army perspective. I think we got to make sure that the forces up there are equipped in the most suitable way possible. We have a tendency, I think, in our Army to want to standardize things for efficiency purposes, and so we don't like to have one-ofs very much. But I think that's kind of short-sighted, and I think there are unique equipping capabilities for a theater like that, a geographical region like that, that you could be penny wise and pound foolish if we're not too careful. So I think that's huge. I don't want to get us in trouble with anybody that thinks we're fighting City Hall on that. But I think making a logical requirements-based argument for something that's so important to the nation's well-being is certainly a professional way to do that. And I think looking at force structure mixes up there, I know we had discussed some things a couple of years ago that we haven't been talking about as much recently. But there's certain things that the Army, as it modernizes and transforms, that we're putting in the field that we should consider whether or not some of those capabilities should be allocated to our northern frontier.
Yeah, I think that's fair, Rich. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You can't be, you know, what is penny wise, pound foolish kind of deal. We've got to be responsible in the structure that we create. We do have a tendency to want to make everything look the same, but you know, it's encouraging to watch the Army as we go through, and we'll develop an Arctic MTO, but it's not going to be so bespoke that it can't be employed elsewhere. You know, we, as a force up here, we've got to be the Army's Arctic and extreme cold weather, division. But I would tell anybody that would listen that I think there's three things we offer the Joint Force. Number one, we are the Army's Arctic and extreme cold weather experts. So we should have an organization that can do that, that's properly equipped and trained to do it. We're also assigned to the Indo-Pacific, so we can compete in the Pacific. Rich, you mentioned, you know, we do go on exercises and operations throughout the Pacific, because we can be there faster than other forces that are CONUS-based. But then the last thing is we are in the global force management pool. So we can't just stand up and say, well, you know, we are so niche and so bespoke that we cannot leave Alaska. We've got to be able to offer that value proposition to the Joint Force that says, if you need a division, we're available. We're in the global force management pool. We'll go anywhere you want us to go. We've got a unique capability. And if you need that capability for, you know, a high latitude, extreme cold weather environment, we think we're your logical choice. But if you need that capability elsewhere on the globe, we're available to you. And I think that's one of the ways that we just have to think about it in that context. We've got to get the structure right for the environment and for the doctrine that we've got. We've got to get, you know, look across the IPF and make sure that we're responsible with it. But again, not get so bespoke that you deploy somewhere else and it is so awkward and so untenable that a joint force commander somewhere in the world says, you gave me a division, but I don't even understand what this one does because it's just so unique. We're not in that space right now. We look like, we look like divisions, but we've got to build a division. We've got to get that Arctic capability right. And so starting from those base MTOs and then modifying them to get to the Arctic, you know, parentheses Arctic capable, get that right. And then we've got a flexible opportunity. You got a flexible force up here that's an Arctic division, but ready to go anywhere.
Yeah, you mentioned, sir, that you all are the Arctic extreme cold weather experts, and definitely agree and want to take the opportunity as well to give special mention to the Northern Warfare Training Center, because we're talking about the manual ATP 390.96, and really some of the institutional knowledge and foundation that was lost over the global war on terror time frame was held at the NWTC. And so they've read every letter in this manual and stamped on it and improved it. And, you know, without that knowledge base, I don't think we would have had near the quality that it is. So the products that are coming out of there, it's a resource, not just for the 11th Airborne, but it's value added for anyone that's operating within the cold.
Yeah, no, thanks, Ed. I'll throw in a plug for CAD period writ large and say, yeah, it was a pleasure to work with you on the doctrine, but it also drives home, you got expertise down in the formation. So when you send those doctrinal reviews out to the field for feedback, we're living proof that, you know, the ivory tower there at Fort Leavenworth is paying attention and incorporating the things in that the field is saying. And it's really building good doctrine for us to use as an Army as a point of departure. We're unique. We've got that unique expertise down in Northern Warfare Training Center, and so certainly willing to lean a heavy shoulder in. But when it comes to other doctrinal publications that you're putting out and you're sending out for review, that feedback from the force, we got to see it come right back up to us in the doctrine that we now get up here. And so we've kind of got only ourselves to blame in some regards. But that collaborative effort, huge for us as an Army and huge for what we need to, you know, it's just something we all need to be, involved in.
I couldn't agree more, sir. Gentlemen, any final thoughts?
Well, I just want to thank you, sir, for taking time out. I know time is scarce as the commanding general up there. You wear many hats. But we really appreciate you taking the time to have this discussion here with us today and put a plug in for having folks, you know, get interested in the doctrine and then want to play an active role in it, because that makes the doctrine better. It's only as good as the people that participate in the writing process. And I'm pretty sure that nobody in our little piece of the ivory tower considers them the subject matter experts on what's going on in the world. So that intellectual humility plus good teamwork, I think, is good for the Army.
Yeah, 100%. I appreciate that. Thanks for giving us an opportunity to participate in this podcast. Tell a little bit of our story, but really, again, that opportunity to shape doctrine, just a great opportunity for us, and we look forward to, you know, continuing to collaborate with you on this and other publications as well.
Thank you both, gentlemen, for the great conversation and for being a part of Breaking Doctrine. Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, Breaking Doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Please don't forget to subscribe on Amazon Music, Apple, Odyssey, Audible, Spotify, or YouTube. Also, please follow us on social media at US Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the US Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Captain Ed Garibay, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.